Welcome to Sightseeing Japan, the podcast where we explore the land of social isolation. I'm Paul Bresson.
And I'm Jason Ealing. Wow. Dark, Paul. Just going right there, huh?
I mean, that's where we're going this episode.
All right. Well, Paul, do you want to start by talking about your relationship with your mother? I was thinking maybe we get Freudian here.
If you want.
Tell me everything. Here, why don't you lay down on the couch? I'll get you a box of Kleenex.
Okay. I don't think I'm going to need it, but...
We're going there, Paul. We're getting real deep.
I love my mother.
How do you feel about hypnosis?
I feel like it doesn't work and that it's a bunch of BS.
Just watch this pendulum, okay?
Okay.
Have you heard the story of Oedipus?
Yes. I don't like where this is going.
Sorry, I don't know.
Where are you going with this?
I'm not sure. I just thought it would be funny.
Actually, thankfully, do not have mother issues, I think. You want to tell me something here, buddy?
No, from what I've seen, you and your mom are totally, normal. And
I won't go that far, but...
I don't know. You're not too messed up.
Thank you. I agree with that.
This is a bad start of the episode, isn't it?
Let's start talking about Japan and not ourselves.
All right.
Japan. Everybody kills themselves, right? Suicide cap of the world, Jason.
Yeah, it's messed up, dude. I don't know, man. Do we need to start this episode over? I feel like this went off the rails from the first word.
We'll get into all the numbers later, but there are a lot of misconceptions about Japan in the Western world.
Yeah, well, so, okay, I was going to start by saying, like, a lot of people might have this image of Japan as, like, a super harmonious society. They got this ancient wisdom. Like, they got everything figured out, you know?
Yeah.
I've heard people say, like, if there's any country on the planet that deserves its own planet, it's Japan, you know?
That's an odd thing to say.
I don't remember who said that, but...
I've heard, like, Japan's 1,000 years ahead of everybody else.
Yeah. And they're using fax machines for all their correspondence.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, people have a lot of ideas about Japan, and the Western media has kind of contributed a lot to those ideas, I think.
Yes.
But Japan's not a utopia, of course. They have their own issues like any country, and I think it's important to view media about Japan from outside of Japan with a critical eye, because Western media outlets sometimes have a tendency to lean towards what might be called Orientalism, where they kind of romanticize cultural aspects of Japan. They exaggerate things almost to the point of making them sound really like mystical. And I read this really interesting article about Orientalism and how it's kind of like a feedback loop. Like, Western media starts reporting on Japan and like how exceptional they are and all these things. And then Japan looks at that and is like, oh, yeah, I guess we are really unique and awesome and we got all this amazing knowledge. And like things like Marie Kondo, you know her, right?
Yeah.
Got really famous for like her organizational skills and the whole, keep the things that bring you joy or whatever, right?
Spark joy.
Did you know that she has kids now?
No.
Well, she does.
I'm not surprised.
And she has said that she cannot keep up with her whole organized thing now that she has kids. Like she,
I believe it.
My point is just that Japanese people are people.
Yeah.
And people are people. And, they're not...
So, since we're already struggling, I'm going to completely derail this here. When I was driving here today, I drove across a bridge, and you know those ancient Egyptian steles, like the big stone
ancient
tower?
Egyptian steles? Is that what you?
Yeah, steles or steles. They were these big monuments that were just like really tall and skinny, and the ancient pharaohs would like write their accomplishments on them.
All right.
Anyways, I was driving by and there was kind of like a mini one of those at the start of the bridge that had some images on it that I couldn't
really
make
this?
Out. The bridge on 35 on the way here.
Okay.
But anyways,
I have no idea where this is going. I have no idea where any of this is going. You sure you don't want to start this episode over?
No.
All right.
No, this relates to your Japanese people are just people thing.
Okay.
It got
okay.
me thinking about, ancient times, the emperors and pharaohs used to build these huge monuments to make the people go,
sure.
Look at their power.
Sure.
But then I thought, you know what? They're just people. They walked by it a million times in their life. They don't even look at it anymore. It just becomes like a normal thing that's there. But in my mind, there's like this mysticism to the ancient times where that doesn't actually exist in the ancient times. It's only made up in my mind.
People absolutely romanticize the past. Yeah. I think a lot of religions even, I don't want to get,
too controversial. We're already off the rails here, bro.
I just think, you know, people look back at ancient times and think, oh, there was all this mystical stuff happening. Like if somebody showed up today and was like, hey, I'm Jesus, I'm the son of God. Everybody'd be like, you're full of crap. You should be in a hospital.
There are people that say that and nobody believes them.
Exactly. But when people look back 2,000 years ago and they're like, yeah, I can totally believe that, you know?
Yeah.
Things were just magicaler back then.
Well, those interesting things where a huge percentage of Americans believe that Jesus is going to come back in their lifetime or around, but nobody believes anybody that says they're Jesus.
Isn't it funny?
It is kind of funny.
Yeah. But I just finished my medieval game, Kingdom Come Deliverance. I just finished it.
Yeah, yeah.
One of my favorite things about that game is that it, like, you get the sense of what life might have actually been like back then. It kind of makes that romanticism drop away a little bit. I mean, it still romanticizes it even in the game, but it tries to be really historically accurate. And it's like, oh, I mean, in a lot of ways, over the past thousands and thousands and thousands of years, humans haven't really changed that much. They've always been pretty much the same.
What do you always say, Jason?
Well, I always say you can't trust people, but what does that have to do with this?
I was thinking people don't change, but I was like, no, right? You know, don't trust people. That's you.
Yeah, that's
I'm going to say people never change.
That's my catchphrase. You know, I asked Yia the other day, what's my catchphrase? And she didn't know. I guess you don't either. You thought it was people don't change or something.
I knew that. I've heard you say that so many times.
Well, anyway, point I was getting at is that people are people. People have problems. People have always had problems. And there aren't magical people, perfect people, you know?
Yeah, we're going to talk a lot of stuff in context of Japan tonight, but none of this is unique to Japan. There are mental health struggles with everybody all over the place.
Exactly. But so in recent decades, I feel like even somebody that's not particularly interested in Japan has probably heard or seen a lot of reports about some of Japan's problems. Like the Western media just likes to report on that stuff. For example, a high suicide rate. You know, almost everybody, I feel like, has heard about the suicide forest.
Yeah.
Or hikikomori, maybe you've heard of, or people working themselves to death. Like, Japan's work culture is kind of notorious.
Or Japan has a loneliness epidemic.
Yep. Or young people aren't having sex anymore. Like, relationships are crumbling. So, you know, I mean, of course, there has to be a seed of truth in all of those, right? To some extent, those are true, but I also think that the Western media tends to sensationalize that kind of stuff, and they really lean into that whole, oh, Japan is such a weird, different place or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And also, once you get those ideas, it's hard to go away.
It's like a confirmation bias kind of thing. Like every time you hear something that kind of leans in that direction, the media just pounces on that.
Exactly.
So all that being said, you know, we're going to do our best in this episode to give you a relatively objective view. We're going to look at some data, look at some statistics, and look at like the attitudes towards mental health in Japan, maybe compare them to our culture here in the USA a little bit. Because, I mean, Japan does like think about mental health a little bit differently due to their unique history and culture.
Well, you brought up statistics, Jason, so I got one.
Okay.
In Japan, only 6% of people have used psychological counseling for mental health problems.
I don't know what the number is in the U.S., but I would guess it's much higher.
52% in Europe and the U.S.
Wow, that is a major difference.
Yes. There seems to be a Japanese attitude of, I can bear this myself. I don't want to burden my family and friends with my problems. So people tend to be less likely to open up about things or seek help sometimes.
I would think that a lot of that difference is probably attributable to, I mean, the very different histories between the Western world and Japan. Like we, in the rice episode, you know, we talked about how like their communal society grew from rice farming and that's influenced all aspects of their society. And in the West, things have been much more individualistic and leaning even further in that direction more recently, I'd say.
Yeah. And that's got to play into mental health, for better and for worse, on both sides, probably.
Yeah.
Because in the West, you're more free to be yourself, live your life the way you want to help you feel better. But in Japan, you're more easily have a place. If you conform, you will be accepted.
But also, if we're talking about like loneliness in the modern age in Japan, I mean, maybe that has something to do with the Western influence of capitalism and like that kind of lifestyle that didn't really exist in Japan until all that Western influence came in, has kind of exacerbated the social isolation.
Yeah. I think a ton of this stuff that Japan is dealing with, they're just slightly ahead of the curve. Like, they were a little bit ahead on low birth rates, low marriage rates, and now most of the rest of the industrialized world is starting to run into those exact same things a decade or two later, probably caused by a lot of the same issues.
Yeah.
But Japan got known for it first.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I have a tendency to lay everything at the feet of capitalism, but I feel like...
Well, that's our system, so you're right. Other systems might also have other problems that they would create as well.
Yeah. It's just that this world that we've built for ourselves, that America has like exported to a bunch of other places around the world. And I mean, and it's not 100% America, but America has been kind of hyper-capitalist. It's not good for human beings. You know, it's not a system that's built to make people happy or mentally well. It's a system that's created to enrich certain people.
Yeah.
The people that control the system.
I think one of the most damning things against capitalism is diseases of affluence. The fact that you can materially have everything you're ever going to need, but you're still depressed, or you're still lonely, or you eat so much that you give yourself diseases, all these sorts of things that are created, even when we supposedly have everything materially that we need. We don't have the things we need in our soul, Jason.
Exactly. It's funny, the people that defend capitalism, it's always like, well, people are richer now than they were, you know, 100 years ago. Like, everybody's got more stuff. It's like, well, maybe more stuff isn't really what we need.
Rich you know? Doesn't do you much good if you're sad and lonely.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you can't feed yourself, that's going to be your first focus in life, right?
Yeah. I think I mentioned in a recent episode that book Sapiens that I had been reading.
Yeah.
That had some really interesting points about how, I mean, capitalism has basically like destroyed communities, and then it has sought to replace all of the things that were once provided by communities by selling people things. You know, it's like we took away all the good things in life, and now we're trying to sell you replacements for all of that. Also, looking back into history, the author kind of makes this argument that perhaps the agricultural revolution was like the worst thing ever to happen to humanity because, you know, before that, when people were hunter-gatherers, they had more varied diets. There weren't famines, widespread famines, until agriculture became how everybody was feeding themselves. And then agriculture made it possible for all these power structures to rise up. And then you have the rich and the poor, and it's been that way ever since, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's kind of controversial, that perspective, but I thought it was interesting.
I think it's gotten to the point where it's fairly well believed that early hunter-gatherers were more healthy than their peers that were farming at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
because of the varied diet, basically.
Well, and more free time. You know, farming is extremely labor-intensive, and going out into the wild and gathering food that's already growing there, it's easier, and you have more leisure time.
And even with neighboring populations, the hunter-gatherers were taller, more well-developed. They seemed to have just a better diet.
I wonder if we're going to get some angry emails about this episode. I'll be interested to see if we're upsetting anyone with these.
People views. Defending capitalism?
Some people do, you know?
Okay, go lick another boot, bro.
I don't
bro.
Know. I see those people online all the time. That's why I try to spend as little time online as possible.
It's true. It's okay if you believe that. I could be wrong. I'm probably not, but I could be, right?
Anyway, I feel like we're veering a little bit away from Japan centric stuff, but
let's move on.
Okay.
Next section is going to be history, but before that,
what's going on before that?
You know what we got before that.
I know what's going on, but I'll go ahead.
Item of the week.
This is the segment where we talk about our favorite items from our friends at bentoandco.com, a website where you can order authentic Japanese bento boxes, cookware, snacks, and more. Paul, do you have an item that you'd like to tell us about today?
Yes. I want to talk about the taiyaki pan. So taiyaki are waffle-like, fish-shaped desserts that are usually stuffed, often with sweet red bean paste, or maybe custard.
Or cheese.
Cheese.
Or like matcha custard. I've seen all sorts of stuff in there.
I saw it recommended to try it with Nutella.
Sounds good. I would eat that.
So you get a pan that's got two sides. It's got two fish on each side. You put in a little
you
batter.
You mean one fish on each side. Two fish total. Right?
No.
This pan has, you can actually make two of them at a time. Is that what you're telling me?
That's exactly what I'm telling you.
Oh my goodness.
So you put a little batter in one side, get it bubbling a little bit, and then you do batter on the other side, get it bubbling a little bit, and then you put the filling in the middle, snap it together, and then cook it for 10 or 15 more minutes till it comes out golden brown and crispy and everything inside's melty and warm.
Sounds tasty.
The only reason I don't already have one is that it's only designed to work on gas stoves, which I currently do not have.
Do you have an induction stove or an electric coil stove?
Electric coil.
Oh, those are the worst.
Yes. So broken heart for me there, but I will get this pan someday.
You have a fireplace, don't you?
Yes.
Well, there you go. Get the pan, stick it in the fire.
Okay. Maybe I'll get it for next time we go camping.
I don't know why you can't use it in your home, in your fireplace.
I suppose I could.
Next time I come over, Paul, I'm going to expect a fresh taiyaki out of the fire. What do you even call that when you just shove something into the fire? A fresh fired...
Fire roasted?
Fire roasted taiyaki. That's what I want.
Okay. All right. If you insist. So you can get this at bentoandco.com. Use our code sightseeing10 for 10% off whatever you order. Or you could use the link on our website, and it will automatically apply the discount for you.
It's on the Support Us website. Just scroll to the bottom, and there's a link. Easy as taiyaki.
I like that. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you. Ready for some mental health history, old buddy?
Oh, yeah.
So the earliest thing I could find about mental health in Japan is that in ancient Japan, mental illness was understood to be caused by mononoke or kitsune, basically spirits. The idea was basically spiritual possession. We talked about, I think in the Tanuki episode, about how foxes were known to possess people, right? And other yokai or spirits or whatever you want to call them. People believed that they would possess people, and that's what caused them to act strangely. Sounds really familiar, right? A lot of other cultures have had similar beliefs, and some people still hold those beliefs.
Yeah. It makes sense in the context of Shinto, being an animism religion where they believe spirits reside in everything.
Absolutely. It makes a lot of sense. So before Western medicine came to Japan, psychotic patients were often treated at temples and shrines by monks, which again, makes a whole lot of sense when you look at things from that perspective. They also had various techniques that they would use that I read about. Did you see any of this stuff, Paul?
Not that ancient.
So they could treat people with water. I saw that they would like have people sit under a waterfall that was supposed to calm them somehow. Okay. Water therapy is apparently the oldest of these methods that they used. Also, treatment with Chinese herbal medicines was common. Or treatment with drums. They called this collaborative conjuration. I thought this was really interesting because it reminded me of music therapy, which is something that's used today with a lot of success.
Interesting.
Yeah. Hmm. In the Edo period, people with severe mental health issues that made it impossible to function in society were often dealt with by confining them in the home. Kind of makes sense, I guess, that would be, I don't know, the only option, maybe. So there was essentially no treatment. Like, they would just lock them up and hope that they didn't get worse.
Yeah.
This practice actually persisted all the way till the mid-1900s, well after Western medicine had made its way into Japan. But to be fair, at that time, Western psychiatry was kind of doing the same thing. You know, there was a time in America when insane asylums were all over, and they just lock people up. And that's kind of, you know, they do things to try to make them better, but most of the time they didn't really get better. So Western medicine and the Western hospital system proliferated around Japan after the Meiji Restoration in 1868, but Western psychiatry had a hard time establishing itself in Japan for multiple reasons. For one, even in the West, it was still a relatively young field. Like I said, they were not having a ton of success, like, curing people. They just lock them up a lot of the time. Also, in Japan, it was competing with the established practices of traditional medicine that came from China. And, you know, people had been doing that for so long, it's hard to just adopt this new system all of a sudden that's looking at the issue from a completely different angle. Also, the government at the time was kind of just viewing Western psychiatry as a tool for maintaining social order. Like, they're just trying to keep crazy people from wandering around. You know, that might be how they were thinking about it at the time. So sure. They didn't really want to invest too much into advancing the field.
The first law passed concerning people with mental illness in Japan was the law for custody for insane people that was enacted in 1900. There were very few mental hospitals in Japan, so the government found it necessary to create a legal way to deal with people with mental illnesses. So this law gave the police the ability to confine people that they deemed unable to fit in with society because of their mental illnesses. Hmm. Most of these people were locked up at home still, though. They didn't really have a lot of places for them. They didn't like keep them in jail necessarily, but the police would be like, you need to lock this person up, and the police would be able to demand that. And the family members were then responsible for monitoring and taking care of them. So it's kind of pushed onto the family. Like, no, this person, please, like, this person can't go outside. You need to take care of them.
That's kind of sad. I don't know. I just have this mental image of, like, kids locked up in cages. Kind of is what makes me think of. Or, like, that one sibling that nobody talks about that's just chained up in the attic or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Going through this old mental health stuff, a lot of it's like, man, that's just awful. But seeing how it progressed over time, it did get me thinking that they were just identifying problems and trying to do something about it. They didn't have all the answers yet. But I mean, imagine schizophrenic people just wandering around causing problems all the time in society. Yeah. They were like, well, this can't happen. We need to do something. And this was the best they could come up with at that time.
Yeah. I mean, you can't be too harsh on people dealing with that, because even now, even with what we know now about psychiatry and how to deal with mental health issues, it can still be one of the hardest things that people have to deal with in their lives, you know? And like, mental health problems can fracture families, you know? Yeah. It can really make things difficult.
Absolutely. In the early 1900s, there was a professor of psychiatry at the University of Tokyo called Shuzo Kure, who decided to investigate the state of these locked up people and how it was working. He had studied psychiatry in the West, so he was aware of how they were doing things in Europe, which made him think, man, Japan's not doing well. He's even got a quote in a book he wrote where he says, for the thousands of mental patients in our country, not only have to suffer the misfortune that brought them this illness, they also have to suffer the misfortune of being born in this country, alluding to the way that they were being treated by the government.
Wow.
So he made a bunch of recommendations for better ways to handle these things. Following his recommendations, the mental hospital law was enacted in 1919, which required that public mental health hospitals were built in each prefecture in Japan. However, because of financial problems and the looming wars coming, this never actually fully got taken care of. And it wasn't until after World War II that most of these facilities got built.
Hmm.
The government was actually kind of clever. After World War II, they didn't have a ton of resources, so they let private hospitals pop up to take care of these people, and they gave them incentives such as, you don't need as many staff per patient as a normal hospital does. to help make it more affordable for them to be able to run and more of them to pop up quickly. They also gave them low interest rate loans as well to develop.
Interesting.
There was an incident that occurred in 1964 where the U.S. ambassador to Japan got stabbed by a 19-year-old Japanese man who had experienced a psychiatric episode. So then there became this big push by people on one side saying, we need to have more laws to be able to lock these people up and confine them. But there was a big pushback from the other side and families of people saying, no, we need a whole new system together of treating these people. And it took a while, but eventually, 20 or so years later, Japan did start moving away from putting people in the hospital towards more community-based counseling and various other approaches like that to deal with mental health issues.
Yeah, it's interesting to see how different countries choose to deal with that, because it is like such a hard issue and people feel so strongly on both sides of it, you know? I don't know. I tend to lean towards like compassion being the most important thing. But of course, you know, when people are violent and stuff, it's like you still need to do something to keep them from hurting themselves or others.
True. But I think where we get lost sometimes is one incident like that will stand out. And right. We need to back up, take our emotions out of it, and look at the numbers. Like, are a lot of people getting stabbed? Or was this just one super high-profile incident?
Yeah.
And kind of go from there a little bit.
So talking about more recent years, I found multiple reports from over the last 20 years or so showing that Asian populations underutilize mental health services compared to pretty much the rest of the world. And there are a few factors that might go into explaining that. One factor is the long history of traditional medicine that spread around Asia from China. You know, even though Western medicine does dominate in Japan and most of Asia these days, it's still relatively new compared to traditional medicine. Also, those medical traditions encourage self-reliance more than Western medicine does, so people are less likely to look for a medical professional and may instead decide to rely on self-care. And in Japan, the cultural atmosphere emphasizes that people are responsible for the care of their family members. So people might be more willing to talk to their family rather than go find some stranger with a doctorate or even friends. I found stats to support that too. Like Japanese elders were found to be more likely to have family they could rely on than friends. So it's like a lot of just keeping it in the family. You don't even want to tell your friends about your really personal problems, you know? Mm. And, you know, the idea of like social harmony in Japanese culture might make people less willing to burden their friends. Not that it would be a burden, but they might feel like they could be a burden and they don't want to put that on other people.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in Japan, even though the mental health care system has improved substantially over the last few decades, most people with disorders, as described by the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, get no treatment. Most people with disorders don't get any treatment. However, the availability of formal mental health care services has substantially improved over recent decades. There are many more psychiatric clinics than there used to be, and a greater variety that can help with different types of problems.
In December 1993, the Basic Law for Persons with Disabilities was enacted, and people with mental disorders were recognized by the law as people with disabilities, which gave them a lot more legal protections.
Yeah, that seems like a big step. I also saw that in 1995, they started a school counselor system.
Nice.
So, yeah, that helps in the school setting.
We had school counselors,
uh-huh.
But did they counsel? The only thing I remember them ever being there for was like to help you plan for college or if you needed to change class.
Yeah.
Did they actually like help with mental health?
I mean, maybe.
Maybe I just didn't.
They never helped me.
Reach out at the time or whatever. Yeah, I don't recall.
I mean, if they had somebody in that situation, I'm sure they'd try to do something.
Or was that the school nurse's job?
I don't know. I mean, you know, in recent years, mental health has become like a huge issue in America, and people are much more willing to talk about mental health struggles. I feel like when we were kids, it just wasn't really a conversation all that much.
True. True. Yeah. I was I had that toxic masculinity. Like, I don't have problems. I can deal with everything myself. Right. I was never going to reach out to anybody about anything.
Right. In Japan, in 2006, they also created a Center for Suicide Prevention. And in 2010, they launched a website called, this is not the best translation maybe, but Comprehensive Site for Everyone's Mental Health. It's basically how it translates.
Awesome.
Where people can go to find info on mental illness services and policies. You know, I realized in the intro, I forgot to say, like, or did we mention, like, we're going to be covering some dark stuff. You know, if you have triggers around mental health struggles, maybe this isn't the best episode. Kind of late to say that.
We did not give that warning.
All right.
But we have now.
Okay. You know, I already said the word suicide, but...
And we... came in with that pretty quick. I came in with that pretty quick, I think.
All right. Well, you can blame Paul, everybody, if that bothers you.
Hopefully the title of the episode was like enough to warn people.
Hopefully. Some people might just press play without really paying attention to the topic. I don't know. Anyway, so despite these recent efforts, things are still going kind of slow in Japan. I found a 2016 survey that showed an increase in service use, like more people are going to mental health facilities, but also still 70% of people with mental disorders still aren't receiving any treatment. That's as of 2016. And the paper I was reading made it sound like there's still little hard evidence to explain why that is. Like, people have ideas, you know, we talked about some possible factors, but it's hard to get like hard data on what exactly is causing this and how to fix it.
Right.
But it does seem like the cultural climate is probably one of the biggest factors. And of course, changes in cultural attitudes take time to change. You know, it can take a really long time. But they are seeing some changes. I saw a study where they asked people what types of treatment they thought were appropriate for various mental health issues. And the younger people were more likely to endorse mental health professionals, whereas older people would suggest just talking to friends. So... you know, I mean, I guess it depends on whether you think that, you know, modern
healthcare
is the best way to go, but that's how things are leaning slowly.
Yeah, mental health is difficult. We still don't have all the answers, but we've made a lot of progress compared to 150 years ago.
Definitely. That's definitely true. A lot less lobotomies.
Yeah, yeah. There are people out there that can help and things out there that can help.
Yeah.
Oh, we can't just cure everything immediately.
So, Paul, want to talk about suicide? Is that not the best way to lead into this section?
I mean, I'm ready to talk about suicide.
Okay.
So, is Japan the suicide capital of the world like it's sometimes made out to be?
No. I think, yeah, a lot of people might have that impression. And might think that suicide is a major social problem in Japan. The Western media, as we said, has kind of focused on that a lot over the years.
I think that leads back a lot to the Japanese bubble popping in the early 90s. And there were stories of salarymen getting laid off or losing all their money and killing themselves. And those stories got played and sensationalized. And that story has just stuck with Japan ever since.
Definitely. Yeah, I think they really started reporting on that. Because, I mean, in any country, suicide rates are closely linked to economic conditions, right? So if there's an economic crash, you're going to see more suicides. And in Japan, there was a spike in 1997 because of the economic downturn. And then there was a peak in 2003. But the suicide rate has been gradually declining ever since. Although there was a recent uptick in recent years that they attribute to COVID.
Which happened a lot of places.
Yeah. So, I mean, yes, I feel like Western media sensationalized it and overemphasized that maybe, and a lot of people probably got a less than accurate sense of that in Japan. But it is still true that suicide is considered a major social issue in Japan. But that's also true in a lot of developed countries.
Yes.
And so, if you want to compare Japan to other
similar
Jason, countries.
I do.
Japan's suicide rate does not make them an outlier.
No. As of 2019, which is the nearest now that I could find numbers for every country, Japan was the 49th highest suicide rate country in the world at 12.2 people per 100,000. For some context, the United States was number 31 at 14.5 people per 100,000. And Japan had been trending downwards for a long time, like you mentioned, where the United States is trending upwards fairly quickly. So we can't say anything. All those stories sensationalized in Japan, like, it's worse here.
True. But also, I mean, a lot of those countries with higher suicide rates are very poor developing countries. So, like, if I feel like you kind of do have to compare Japan to other countries with similar economic conditions. You know?
Well, I got some more.
Okay.
So the top 10 countries, like you mentioned, were all in Africa or small island nations. Number 11 was Russia. And number 12 was South Korea.
Yeah, there were a few. So I had four listed here that I thought were notable that had higher suicide rates than Japan. The U.S., South Korea. Also, I was surprised to see Sweden and Finland up there.
It's the being that far north.
Oh, the little sunlight.
Yeah, I think that doesn't help. Yeah.
But dude, South Korea has a scary high suicide rate.
Yeah. So we said 12.2 per 100,000 for Japan, 21.2 for Korea. That's way higher.
Yeah. But nobody talks about South Korea as the suicide capital. They just talk about K-pop.
Right, right. For more context, the world average is 9. So Japan at 12.2 is a little bit over the world average. Okay. So definitely an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But not as crazy as some people would imagine. What's believed to be some of the leading causes of suicide in Japan include financial anxiety, bullying, which has been an issue that's been receiving a lot more attention in Japan lately, isolation, and lack of mental health care. I also found an interesting note that we mentioned suicides bumped up in 2020 because of side effects of the COVID pandemic and possibly lockdowns and other things. Women seem to be a bit more affected by that, who usually have a much lower suicide rate than men. And there were some interesting possible reasons I saw for that, including the industries that got most affected by the lockdowns, like retail, hospitality, tended to be industries that women are more heavily working in.
Mm.
Also, the idea, if the school gets shut down, who's taking care of the kids? That's an extra burden on the women in the household. They're taking care of the kids now and doing everything else. And the third possibility I saw was that women that were in abusive relationships were now stuck in the house with that person and had nowhere else to go.
Interesting. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I guess I forgot to put in my notes that in almost every country in the world, the suicide rate for men is much higher than for women.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about how suicide is viewed in Japan. That may be a little bit different than some other places.
Yeah. I saw that one major factor could be that Christianity has not been much of a thing in Japan historically. Like, Christianity kind of has certain things to say about suicide, but in Japan, like, suicide is not viewed as a sin. In fact, historically, it can even be seen as a way of taking responsibility. Like, going back to the idea of seppuku, ritual suicide, that was a way to preserve honor. It was actually the best thing you could do in certain situations.
Yeah. Honorable, showing a sense of strength and that you were willing to end your own life than let yourself be captured.
Mm-hmm.
It's glorified a bit, especially in the history, the way things are retold.
Yeah.
But then there's the more recent history of the wars, World War II, kamikaze pilots purposefully killing themselves in attacks, or bonsai charges where you'd have whole large groups of infantrymen just charge into machine gun fire, knowing they were probably all going to die.
I remember learning that in Okinawa, when the Americans were coming, whole families would just gather around a grenade and they would all just kill themselves rather than be captured or let the Americans do whatever to them.
There was a lot of propaganda about how bad the Americans were going to be.
Yeah. Another interesting point in Japan is that insurance companies will pay out in case of suicide, which I don't believe is usually the case in the U.S. So some elderly people might feel like dying is the best thing they can do for their family, which is kind of sad.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I saw that some experts actually think that the actual suicide rate in Japan could be much higher than what's reported, because when elderly people die, like, police aren't going to investigate as much, you know. A lot of the deaths could be suicides, yeah, but the police just aren't looking for that.
Interesting.
Yeah. Also, as we mentioned already a couple times, like, economic instability is a major driver of suicides. And Japan has a really unique economic climate because, like, it used to be a country where people were employed for life. Your company would take care of you. There was a real loyalty between the workers and their employers. And, you know, there was the really prosperous time. And then after the bubble burst, it's kind of stagnated since then. So the kind of situation where your company takes care of you, that's much less the case now than it used to be. And a lot of young people these days have trouble finding stable jobs. So that can easily contribute.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess I did have it in my notes here. 70% of suicides in Japan are men. I also want to mention that I saw that the number one precursor for depression and suicide is isolation. And I think we're going to see isolation as a common theme in a lot of these issues that we're talking about in this episode. Like, if you wanted to try to distill it down to one cause for mental health issues, isolation is huge.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's why capitalism is bad for people. Should I leave that in? Or
your choice. Well, I think that leads into Karoshi. Are you ready to talk about this one?
Let's talk Karoshi.
Okay. So Karoshi means overwork death. It's a Japanese term related to sudden deaths from overworking.
Yeah, people literally work themselves to death.
It usually manifests in the form of heart attacks, strokes due to stress, or malnourishment.
Yeah, when I'd first heard about Karoshi, I always wondered, like, how does this work? You know, do people just, like, drop dead at work? I mean, sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, basically, literally, yes.
So some of the deaths I saw are actually suicides caused by work stress. That counts as Karoshi, apparently.
There's another term for that.
Okay.
Karojisatsu, overwork suicide.
Okay.
But yeah, they're very tied together, linked together.
Yeah. But also a lot of Karoshi incidents are sudden deaths caused by conditions that are directly caused by overwork and stress, like strokes and heart failure.
Yeah. And this stuff is super hard to identify and track. Like, a 36-year-old dies from a heart attack at work. It's hard to say exactly that was work, but then you go back and look and say, oh, this person worked 200 hours of overtime in the last month, and that's how it gets classified this way.
Yeah. And overwork tends to lead to a lot of risk factors for all sorts of diseases, like excessive smoking and drinking, impaired sleep, lack of exercise, social isolation, the big one.
Yeah.
All those things are going to impact your life expectancy. And I found that a 2016 government survey, they found that around 1 in 5 Japanese workers are at risk of Karoshi.
Oh, man.
Based on, I guess, the number of hours that they're working and stuff. So you've probably heard about, like, Japan's intense work culture before, right? It's kind of another one of those things that's really emphasized in Western media. And of course, there is truth there.
Yes.
A lot of people do work just totally insane hours. Like, I saw, I mean, specific examples of people working like 160. I mean, you said 200. Did you actually see an instance of 200 overtime hours per month?
I mean, I didn't put it in my notes, but some of the numbers were crazy. So yeah. I just pulled up a crazy number.
All right. Well, I definitely saw at least one that was like 160 hours. So think 160 hours.
That's 80 hours a week you're working.
Exactly. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
16 hours every single day.
When do you sleep, eat, socialize? Like, all of, you get behind on all of those things, and that leads to really poor health.
Yeah.
And the stress.
But especially these days, Karoshi, or overwork death, is not a uniquely Japanese thing, is it, Paul?
No, it's definitely not.
I found a stat from the World Health Organization that in 2016, 745,000 people died from stroke and ischemic heart disease as a direct result of working at least 55 hours a week.
Wow.
So these days, I mean, in Japan and around the world, I think it's becoming more accepted that it's not healthy for people to work that much.
Yes.
And fortunately, some countries are taking steps to address that. In Japan, in 2018, Shinzo Abe introduced a work style reform bill that was supposed to make employers force employees to take time off, and they capped overtime at 80 hours a month. But, I mean, for one thing, 80 hours of overtime per month is still 60-hour weeks.
Yeah.
So you're still at risk of karoshi. And they made an exception for what they called special months, where employers could demand up to 100 hours of overtime. So that's insane. And that's why workers need to fight for their rights, because companies will never give it up willingly.
Yeah. I'm kind of torn on that one, because is it a start? You know, like, now there's a law, now there's a limit, or is the limit so high that it now enables companies to, like, oh, well, that's the law. We can work you that hard, and they're more free to work you that hard up until that limit?
That's a good question. Also, how do you enforce that stuff? Like,
not easily.
Especially because it's so ingrained in the culture. Like, I saw a lot of instances where they said that they implemented some reform. But then even the workers sometimes are like, well, I can't follow that rule because then I'm going to look like a bad worker or whatever, you know?
Yeah. It definitely does seem to be getting better. There's still companies where it's really bad. They're now called black companies. Mm. And they have a reputation where, no, they work you to the bone. They're awful. They treat you poorly. And other companies have gotten a little better. I do a couple examples. Toyota Motor Company, for example, has capped overtime at 360 hours a year, which is 30 hours monthly. So still a bit, but less than 50 hours per week.
Still more than I want to work.
True, true. But it's a start. That's better, right?
Sure.
They also have some offices where they play an announcement supposedly at 7 p.m. saying, it's important to rest and go home and get sleep. I also heard that Japanese people are reacting to this. A lot of young people are choosing part-time hourly work versus a standard salaried job where who knows how long you're going to work.
Yeah. I've been hearing that for a long time in Japan, that younger people aren't as interested in careers, more interested in just jobs that can keep them alive.
Yeah, I mean, when the careers suck, like, what are you going to do?
But then the question is, like, how do you prepare yourself for the future, you know? I don't know, maybe it's just my fear of the future that, like, I need to save for retirement
true.
But it's like, are you just going to work until you die? I feel like a lot of people these days, that's their retirement plan, is just, I'll just see what happens.
One thought I had is that they have a way better healthcare system than us.
That's true.
So they don't have to worry as much about, I need a full-time job so that I can have insurance and I can pay for all that. So they have a little more freedom there. They might be able to save some money every month just working hourly.
Yeah. I've also heard that Japanese people are really good at saving money, like relative to other countries. People just save a lot more of their money. But again, like, if you have a part-time job, it'd make that a lot harder to do.
Yeah. I'm also unsure about definitions in Japan. Part-time, I feel like it's thrown around sometimes for people that actually work a lot because they're not salaried, which is full-time. So you might be working a lot of hours and be making a decent amount of money and still be part-time.
And you could work multiple part-time jobs
and end up
working full-time hours anyway.
Yep, yep. Should we move on to your favorite one, Jason?
My favorite mental health issue?
Yeah. Not from your mouth, from my mouth.
I mean, it's fair.
Hikikomori.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what favorite means, but I do think this is, personally, I find it the most fascinating.
Right. That's what I meant.
So hikikomori is essentially severe social withdrawal. The word can be applied to the people in this condition or to the condition itself. Essentially, hikikomori will withdraw entirely from society. They will, like, confine themselves to their rooms or their homes. They don't talk to anyone. I mean, a lot of them just never, ever leave their room. They're modern-day hermits is the easiest way to think about it. Most of them live in their parents' houses, and they refuse to go to school, go to work, go anywhere. generally people are considered hikikomori if they've been isolated for at least 6 months, avoiding social situations and relationships. I also thought it was interesting, just like reading about the criteria, experts seem to agree that an important criterion is that their situation does not have another psychological problem as its principal source.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Like if somebody has bipolar or schizophrenia and that's what's causing their seclusion, they wouldn't call that hikikomori.
Sure.
But also, like, the more I read about it, the more kind of shaky that seems, because there are a lot of comorbidities, or however you want to call it. Like, and I mean, part of it is like the difficulty in classifying mental disorders, you know? They come out with a new DSM all the time and they classify things in different ways. It's like, what do you call, you know, just the way a person is, and what do you call a mental illness?
Yeah, I don't know. Because I was wondering about this too, like, what if you're like severely autistic and you can't interact well with people, so you just stay at home with your parents? Like, does that count as hikikomori, or is that you're just autistic?
Yeah. Well, another thing is, I mean, thinking about hikikomori, I always think back to like when people were living in these really small, tight-knit communities where everyone had a role to play. Hikikomori couldn't exist in that type of community, you know?
Yeah.
Like you know, everybody has a role to play. You're always around other people. You can't just withdraw into a room forever. That's why capitalism is horrible, that it enables and encourages this kind of stuff.
Well, that leads me. I found somewhere where they studied why this was possible in Japan. And the three main factors they found was, one, middle class affluence. Did I get it, Jason? Close enough?
I'll take it.
In a post-industrial society, allowed the parents to be able to support adult children at home indefinitely. This isn't really the case for poorer people, because the kids just have to go work. They just have to go out in the world and work. They don't have the privilege of being able to stay at home like this.
Yeah.
The second factor is the inability of parents to recognize this as an issue, or to be hard enough on the kids to be able to get them to go do something. And sometimes there are codependency issues between mother and kids, or father and kids too. Mm. And the third one is back to economics. Basically, people losing hope that they're ever going to get a good job, or that they're ever going to succeed in life, so they don't even try anymore and seclude deep within themselves. The hikikomori phenomenon is a little bit hard to document, but there are some studies that have been out there. Do you have any numbers about the prevalence of this issue in Japan, Jason?
I do. I actually have a really recent stat from April 2023.
Oh, wow.
It said that 1.46 million working-age people in Japan are living as hikikomori.
What?
That's about 2% of the population of working-age people.
That's wild.
Isn't that?
That's wild.
Yeah. So that's like people between 15 and 64 years old. About 2% of all those people are just total recluses.
They're already dealing with a shrinking workforce, and then they got a million plus people just refusing social interaction. Wow.
And they think that about 20% of those people became recluses during the pandemic. 20%.
Yeah, I believe it. Absolutely. The pandemic did weird things to people.
Yeah. So I looked back a little further to see if I could like compare that statistic to one, you know, 10 years before.
Yeah.
The Japanese government stats from 2010 said that at that time, there were about 700,000 hikikomori with an average age of 31. So that's like about doubled between 2010 and 2023.
Wow.
Yeah.
And the population in Japan isn't really increasing. So that's just percentage going up.
Right. And I think another important thing to realize is, like, you might think at first that this sounds like a young person thing, you know, like, oh, kids refuse to go to school or go to work or whatever, and they're living in their parents' basement or something. But this can actually affect all ages. Some people even become hikikomori much later in life. And I saw a survey from 2019 that showed there are around 613,000 hikikomori between ages of 40 and 64.
Wow.
So that could be a major social issue in the future, because what happens when their parents die, you know? Yeah, I think in America, at least, there's kind of this stereotype of like the neckbeard living in his parents' basement or whatever. But imagine people in their 40s and 50s living in their parents' house. There's actually even something they call like the 2030 problem, where a lot of those older people that are taking care of these hikikomori are going to pass away. And then what do you do with those people? Like,
yeah.
How are they going to live? Are they just going to die in their homes?
I did get the impression that some of these older people might have their own homes. There were some of the older men that were never married or had kids. With economic downturns, they might have got laid off or forced to retire early. And then they just lost all social interaction because they don't really have friends outside of work. They don't have a family anymore. And they just live at home by themselves.
I think that's going to tie into our next topic
yes,
that we're going to talk about.
Is.
But so, Paul, you mentioned some of the reasons that people might become hikikomori. I kind of had a bunch of stuff to expand on there, if you don't mind.
Or I think I talked about the reasons that enabled them to kind of exist in the Japanese society.
Societal conditions that allow that to happen. So usually hikikomori start withdrawing from society gradually. Like, it's not like just all of a sudden one day they decide, I'm not leaving home. People at risk probably don't have many friends, probably just aren't very happy or secure in their lives in general. And they might start talking less and less. But sometimes hikikomori can be triggered relatively suddenly by traumatic events. Like, that's not unheard of. You know, somebody loses a job or gets a physical injury, and that just kind of all of a sudden, like, they're at home all the time and they just never leave. But I think more commonly, it's a gradual thing. And as I mentioned, this can affect all ages and all types of people. Apparently, it even affects men and women equally, which kind of surprised me given the, you know, difference in suicide rates and stuff.
Yeah, the idea in my mind is definitely a guy.
Yeah. But the most widely reported cases, at least, the ones that get the most attention, tend to involve eldest sons, because Japanese society places so much pressure on the eldest son to succeed and, you know, be the new family leader or whatever, right?
Yeah.
So if they fail socially or academically, that can really be a major blow to their self-esteem, their confidence out in society. A lot of people attribute the prevalence of hikikomori in Japan to the unique stresses of Japanese society. And we already kind of touched on some of this, like the job market. Also, you might have heard about how intense school life can be in Japan. We mentioned bullying earlier. Entrance exams are a huge deal. Like, that's a huge amount of pressure for kids. And Paul, have you heard people talking about like the idea of creating a mask for yourself? Like, Japanese people talk about how you have like this mask that you wear out in public and you have to hide who you really are. I think that probably contributes to feelings of isolation, you know?
Sure. I mean, me at work.
Sure. I mean, that's but true anywhere. Like I said, none of this is like 100% unique to Japan.
Right.
It's just
not quite to that extent. There's a few things I tone back, but I'm mostly myself.
Yeah. Modern technology can also contribute, of course. It's easy to see how that could be a major factor. Like, social media is not good for anybody, in my personal opinion. And I've been told recently that I rant sometimes on the podcast. I recognize that.
Who told you that?
You don't need to know.
Okay. I do think about sometimes, like, what would you do as a hikikomori without technology? If you didn't have internet and you didn't have TV or radio, I mean, you could read books. Like, there's still a few things you could do, but I almost feel like it would get harder to isolate yourself and be okay with it.
We've built ourselves technological prisons, Paul.
Yeah.
I have a rant to go on for a minute. I'm just kidding.
Do it. Do it. Rant.
No. I don't think we have time for that.
All right.
Okay, so do you want to talk about what Japan has been trying to do to address the hikikomori issue?
Yeah, let's do that. One way to deal with this is to try to get hikikomori people to join with community social centers and participate in therapeutic activities. They often do this with family members for support, and it is difficult to get hikikomori to show up to these things, but they encourage the family to go even without them, and they teach the family ways to interact and try to deal with these things and normalize interactions as well.
I thought that was really interesting that they can like focus on the family and how the family responds to the person suffering. Because I feel like, I mean, to some extent, there's enabling happening there, right?
Right. I was going to say, I don't want to blame the family, but there's definitely something going on there. If you have a certain type of parents, you probably will never become a hikikomori because it's not an option, right?
Yeah. I've seen like documentaries on YouTube about various nonprofits that work to help integrate people into society. I thought that was really interesting. Like they'll even employ former hikikomori that will go out to where the hikikomori are living, and they'll talk to them through the door and be like, I've been where you are. I know what it's like.
Home visits.
There you go.
We're marking this one explicit, right?
Yeah.
That reminds me of a doujinshi I read once.
Really? That's okay.
Anyways. They had a special way of curing people in that one.
I'm sure they did. One thing that I came across that I thought was kind of interesting is there's a company that produces DVDs of women just staring into the camera and like talking.
Yeah.
So it's like the hikikomori can get kind of this sense of personal interaction without actually having to interact with somebody. So it's almost like a first step towards being able to talk to a human being again, you know, or at least even make eye contact.
Yeah. I did see an interview a few years back about one of these people that does do the home visits, and she kind of played the role of like big sister. And she's like, I talked to them through the door, and sometimes eventually they let me inside, and I just develop a personal relationship with them, and that helps them feel confident to get back into society with other people as well.
Yeah.
Which seems really cool. Like, what a thing to do.
Yeah, definitely.
I also thought it was interesting that the treatment for this is not drug-based. Unless they diagnose some other mental problem along with this, they might give you medicine for that.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is not fixed with a prescription. It's fixed with social interaction.
Yeah, it's one of those things that's like, I mean, all of these issues that we're talking about feel like they're symptoms of societal problems. You know, they're showing how society is failing to serve its people.
Yeah.
So the last thing I had about hikikomori is I was looking for statistics about hikikomori in the U.S. to see if I could make some meaningful comparisons there, you know?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
People talk about it as if it's a uniquely Japanese thing, but it's absolutely not. There are people that withdraw from society all over the world. So I didn't find a ton. There are definitely hikikomori in the U.S., but it's very hard to say how many because, I mean, mainly just people aren't paying that close of attention, you know? They have a word for it in Japan. It's a known thing. They're gathering statistics on it. In the U.S., the people living like this are basically ignored. We don't have the same clinical criteria to help us identify hikikomori. And so, I mean, we just don't have the framework to even track the numbers at all. Even in Japan, I mean, even with the framework they have, it's still hard to get really solid numbers just because of the nature of the condition. Like, people aren't exactly forthcoming with that situation, you know? People don't want to self-report that. The one thing I did find is a study from 2019 where they found that 2.7% of a sample of American university students had been hikikomori in the past.
Interesting.
2.7% of university students. That's like the only survey or study I could find. But anecdotally, I know that those people exist, right?
Yes.
Another sad phenomenon in Japan relating directly to loneliness and isolation is called kodokushi, or lonely death. This is basically where people die alone and are undiscovered for a long time, sometimes years even. This idea first came to public attention in the 1980s and has actually become more of a problem as Japan's population ages, more elderly people live alone, and they end up dying alone with nobody checking on them a lot of the time. So again, I mean, a lot of this stuff, it's hard to get stats because by definition, these people are undiscovered. You know, they die and then nobody finds them for a long time. but I saw one estimate of around 30,000 of these cases per year. And the people most in danger of this are men who are 50 or older, because as Paul, you mentioned earlier, once you're not working anymore, really easy to get isolated. Like a lot of them, especially with Japan's intense work culture, they might not have had time to build those close family ties. You know, they're spending so much time working that once they're done working, they're just not close to anybody. So a lot of these older men live alone. They might have their bills automatically deducted from their bank account. That's kind of a major reason why they're not discovered for so long, is that the only people that care, or the only people that would care, are the people not getting their money. And yeah. They're getting their money, so they don't care.
Yeah. This is the one, honestly, that like hits home for me. I could see this in my future, possibly.
I'm going to be checking up on you, Paul. Come on.
I hope so.
Unless I die first.
But if I outlive my immediate family and I never get married and don't have kids and I'm not working anymore, who would notice? I don't know. Hopefully that I'm out volunteering and I do things and I have a healthy retirement.
We got our group of friends, Paul. You'd have to be pretty unlucky to be the last one alive.
Yeah, I hope I don't die after all of you guys. That's not fair.
Yi and I always joke about, I'm going to die first. You're going to be stuck living without me.
Don't do that to me. Come on.
So why does Kotokushi happen? I mean, obviously, social isolation is the biggest thing. And that's a major problem for older people in any developed country, right? Again, the disintegration of the tight-knit communities caused by capitalism. No.
Yeah. I think it might have a lot to do with our identities based on our work. So many people, like, I'm a banker, I'm a grocer, I'm a whatever. Once you retire and you don't have that anymore, who are you? What are you? If you don't have a family living with you, you might not be close to anybody anymore.
Yeah. And in Japan, like in the past, it used to be that you lived in a multi-generational household and you most likely worked with your family. Like you'd have a family business and you're all working together to make it successful. But once capitalism comes along and anybody can just go work for some big company, you don't have those ties anymore. Yeah.
I think it's easier to develop social apathy these days, where it's like, it's more work to go get to know somebody. I can just watch TV instead.
Yeah.
Easier to break down those connections.
So some areas in Japan have actually started social programs to try to address Kotokushi. They will set up social events and check in on older residents periodically. So that's a nice idea, but it's also hard problem to solve. You know, you don't always know that you're casting a wide enough net and finding the people that are at risk of it.
Yeah. I saw a really cool article about a Japanese artist named Miyu Kojima.
Me too. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. You saw her models that she builds.
Yeah. I thought that was really cool.
She works as a cleaner who helps empty homes of people who died alone.
I don't think she does anymore, but she used to work there. Yeah.
And she builds miniature compositions of those rooms that she cleaned.
Yeah, like little dioramas of the place where she found a dead body and had to clean it up. So it's like preserving the end of their life, basically, you know, the way that they were living. It's like, I'm going to show this to the world just to kind of bring awareness to it.
Yeah. I also saw her say in an interview that her father suffered that fate and that she regrets not having a close relationship with him.
I didn't see that, but that's really sad and makes sense that would motivate her to do that.
Yeah.
She published a book with like pictures of all of her dioramas. It's called Tokiga Tomata Heya, which means the room where time stopped.
Mm.
I thought it was a really
poignant name,
yeah. She also has essays in there about that.
Well, shall we move on, Jason?
I got one more thing to talk about.
Well, what's our last topic today?
It's called Gomi Yashiki. This is another phenomenon that can sometimes go hand in hand with some of these other conditions, especially Hikikomori and Kotokushi. Basically, Gomi Yashiki translates to garbage house. And this is definitely not a purely Japanese thing. We have them here in the U.S. We call them hoarder houses, usually. Places where garbage just piles up more and more and more until people are living in squalor in these little horrifying places, frankly.
Yeah. I saw that the problem's often linked to obsessive compulsive disorder.
I saw mentions of that too.
I'm not sure exactly why that makes you not able to throw away trash.
Well, I don't think it's that OCD causes this. It's that compulsive hoarding is like a subset of what they call OCD, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So again, like social isolation is one of the primary factors that leads to this. A lot of people that fall into this situation are elderly and living alone. They might be widowed, estranged from relatives. You know, the less people you have coming by, the easier it is to let things get worse and worse, and you just don't have the motivation to kind of clean things up, and eventually it just gets out of hand, you know?
Yeah, it gets so bad that it's like, I can't do anything now anyways.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's hard. Like you said, I saw a lot of mentions of like obsessive compulsive stuff, but at the same time, it's like a lot of places seem to talk about it like it's hard to classify. Like, can you really call it its own mental illness? Like, if there aren't other OCD symptoms involved with it, is compulsive hoarding a mental illness on its own?
You know?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
I don't really watch South Park anymore, but I did see a clip, I think, on Instagram where, like, Kyle becomes a hoarder and they try to clean out his locker and they like, try to throw everything away. And he's like, I might need that half-eaten moldy sandwich later. You can't throw that away. And everyone's just looking at him like, oh, my God.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess, based on what I read, like they've done a lot of research on it in recent decades, but it still seems like very little is known about it. What exactly causes it? What the risk factors are? Is it its own mental illness or a symptom of a different mental illness? I mean, again, psychiatry, it's just hard to pin things down because it's kind of one of those softer sciences.
Is it even a mental illness?
Couldn't tell you, Paul.
Okay.
I'm sure there are people that spend their lives studying it and we'll still don't have all the answers.
Yeah. It does become a societal problem, though, because it can lead to odors, rodents, bugs that can spread to neighboring properties.
Yeah. And sometimes, I mean, if you're talking gomiyashiki, you're just talking about trash houses. There's not always somebody living in there. I saw that in some cases, these houses end up this way just because neighbors will start to dump trash at a residence that's unoccupied.
Yeah.
And it just turns into a garbage house.
I saw that too.
That sucks.
Yeah, it does.
I wasn't expecting to reference the Yakuza video games in this episode, but there's actually a side quest in one of those games where you have to talk to this guy who's like living in one of these trash houses. This is interesting that it's a big enough social issue that it made its way into this video game, you know?
Yeah.
But like, once you get to know this guy, you find out that like his wife died and he just couldn't throw away anything that belonged to her, you know? And things started piling up and it was a really kind of sad, touching story,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that is. It's also really difficult to deal with from the outside because even though it's trash, it's still private property. So you can't just go take it legally.
Mm-hmm.
You also can't trespass on their property either. So some municipalities have enacted specific ordinances to be able to allow themselves to send someone in there to take care of it because there are legal issues with going onto someone's property and throwing their stuff away for them.
Yeah. Well, Paul, that was a lot. I gotta say, that was a challenging episode, I'll say. Like
it was.
I was a little intimidated by the research. Like, how do you take these huge issues and distill them down into an hour? I hope we did okay. I hope our listeners learned something new and found it interesting.
Yeah, we danced around the tip of the iceberg. There's a heck of a lot there, but it was a lot of interesting stuff, I think.
Yeah, I definitely learned a lot. Well, before we go, definitely want to thank our Shogun level patrons.
Yeah.
Wesley C., Nicholas McKibben.
What?
It's so ingrained in me. It's like I try to say it normally and then my body just like takes over and tries to turn. No, that's silly. That's too silly for this episode, right? I need to cut that out.
I think we need some silliness after that.
All right. I'll leave it in. Now I just feel silly.
I hope all his friends yell at him like that. He's walking by, Nicholas McKibben, what's up, bro?
Kevin Harris, Brady K, Jack, Michael Morris, David Imani, Jennifer Crutchfield, Ethan Teague, Darwin Perrier, Max, and Katarina and Ellery. Thank you all so much. We really, really appreciate you.
Thank you very much.
And for everyone who's not a member, please consider joining the Patreon. We got a bunch of good stuff up there, and I'm excited to do more cooking videos and folk tales, and there's going to be just more and more stuff coming up there. But if you don't want to join the Patreon, maybe you don't have a few bucks to throw our way, you can also help us by telling a friend or telling the world in the form of a review. Paul, what are we talking about next time? I don't even remember.
We're going to be talking about some of the best Tokyo day trips.
Ah, that will be good.
Yeah, there's a lot of options we can choose from for that one.
Definitely. So how many hours away do you think we're talking here? Like, how close does it need to be a day trip? 2 hours?
About 2 hours. All like, right. I'd say Nikko counts. Although yeah. We don't need to cover that because we did a whole episode on it.
Well, we've done whole episodes about Nikko and Kawagoe, which are two big ones. So
true.
We can reference those episodes, but I'm sure we'll have a bunch of other stuff to talk about.
Yeah.
Kamakura. We already did a whole episode
yes,
of that.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
There'll be a lot of good stuff.
Yep.
All right. Well, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.